All right, let's go to the Zoom line where we've got Kenley Nebaker with Train ND Northwest, as well as Levi Perkins with Perkins Electric Innovation. This is our update here on the Evolution, EVolution Hybrid. It's a project that Train ND North Dakota and Perkins Electric Innovation are doing in partnership with the United States Commerce Department. Is that correct? It's the federal one, Kenley?
Yeah, federal governments. This is ultimately being paid for, at least 80% paid for by a grant from the federal Department of Commerce. Yeah.
So, folks, if you want to go to the crudelife.com or esgu.org, we have the following links with the history of this. So, if you want to track last month, I think we did some different weights and some different torque involved with the evolution that's happening, the evolution of the hybrid. But folks, what we're talking about here is in one of those traditional semis that you see. Get on a great big convoy semi, and we're going to try to figure out a way to grab an EV motor into a combustion motor, combine them together, and get more than 2 miles a gallon. Kenley, how are you doing today? Levi, how are you doing today? And let's talk about the motor today. There's a couple different options, so let's start off with laying the groundwork, Kenley. What kind of motors are we looking at here?
Yeah, we're first of all, good morning, and thanks for having us on. And we're excited about where the project is going. We're having a lot of conversations about design and what we want to do, and one of the big conversations has definitely been around the electric motor and which direction we want to go. Currently on the market, there's multiple options. You can kind of go with what's been seems to be real popular here in the United States, as we see these electric vehicles, fully electric vehicles, move forward, which is the idea of having multiple small motors inside of an axle to drive the wheels, and that seems to be a real popular direction here in the United States with the electric vehicles, with the fully electric semis like the Tesla and whatnot. The other option that you really have, and there's different divisions within those small motors within the axles. The other option that we've been exploring, and I think that Levi can kind of talk about this, but I think we're leaning towards is having one big electric motor that then drives a drive line that then drives the axles. And so I think we're excited to see, and I think that this is a great conversation for us to have and kind of share what we're thinking and why we're thinking it.
All right, Levi, talk a little bit about the different types of engines and the selection process that's going into this.
Yeah, so I think in the past, a lot of the electric vehicles that we've seen on the market, whether it be a very small passenger vehicle like a car or even a small utility pickup, a lot of times they're going to utilize an electric motor, and it could be like a permanent magnet type DC motor. Some of these are AC induction motors that they use, and some of them are brushed and some of them are brushless, but regardless, a lot of times we're seeing that because these electric motors, just the inherent capabilities of them at zero RPM or just barely off of starting to turn, they can actually produce peak torque with no RPM. So it reduces the need for a gearbox at all. And that's kind of cool. A lot of these electric vehicles, they don't have any kind of gear reduction. Some of them will have an overdrive, but a lot of them don't, because the motors can go from zero to like 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 RPMs, which is similar to an internal combustion, like a piston style engine, but they can build peak torque at very low, if any, RPM. So we're just, and right now on the class 8 truck side, or maybe even like medium duty class 5 trucks, a lot of the class 5 electric vehicles that have been on the market the last 10 years, they don't have any gearbox. They don't have a gear reduction. So it's just a motor to a driveline to a rear axle. And the rear axle oftentimes will have very a traditional gear ratio on it, like a you know, so, like on a pickup, you could have 3.55-1 gear ratio or 4.10 gear ratio. And essentially that's just a 4-1 reduction in the ring gear to the axle shafts that the tires are bolted to. So we're seeing a lot of these class 5 medium duty van trucks that are electric or have been converted to electric. They don't have a gearbox in them. And that's kind of exciting. It simplifies the drivetrain. So in essence, instead of, and this is where it becomes very attractive to consumers, instead of having a reciprocating piston diesel engine, and then you've got all the complexity of the fuel side of it and what type of, you know, you got to get good ultra low sulfur diesel fuel and the filters and high pressure common rail injection systems, and it needs to be turbocharged, and a lot of them will have overhead camshafts, and then you've got to have a gearbox, and it could be automated or not automated, it could be stick shift or an automatic, and then all of that is, the engine has an after treatment system for the reduction of NOx and particulate matter, and lots of complexity in that system, whereas this other system is just a motor, a controller, and batteries. So it's attractive in that regard, and I think that there's a lot of different directions you can go with the motor, and hopefully today we get to talk a little bit about directions and ways that we can do it to even simplify the drivetrain more.
When you're looking at Tesla or one of these Ion 6, or I know Audi has one too. What kind of motors do they have in comparison to what you're talking about, just for the average consumer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we'll see on those, a lot of times, older electric vehicles that we saw in the 90s, a lot of those had 300 to 400 volts DC to permanent magnet motors. And they were DC motors, and some of them were even brushed DC motors. So there would be maintenance involved with them. And some of the early electric conversions that you could do to a gas vehicle to take the piston engine out and put an electric motor in, they were actually brushed DC motors. So these newer ones, now what they've done, and this is really smart, if you think about to simplify this, if you'll think about the electric drill market right now. 15 years ago, we used to have these like 12 volt electric drills. They were really low power. They had brushed DC motors. They were really heavy. They probably had nickel cadmium batteries. They didn't have a lot of duty cycle, really high, you know, minutes or hours of charge time. Just not convenient. People didn't like them. But as things progressed, we went to brushless motors or permanent magnet motors, like if you think of Milwaukee or DeWalt or some of these, and then we went to higher voltage. So we would see 16 volts a long time ago, and then 18, and then 20, and then even 24 volts. And some of them, for a while, we had 28 volt flex systems. And same thing with the electric vehicle market. Now we're seeing 600 volts is the standard. And we even have some vehicles that are running in the 800 volt range, and some medium duty trucks and class 8 trucks that are in the 800 volt range, because we can potentially consume, we can extract more power, useful power out of a smaller battery pack if the voltage is higher. And it's dangerous. I mean, if people have ever told you that you can't be killed by DC voltage, that's a lie. It's just the fact that our common DC voltages that we work around are like 12 volts, 14 volts, 20 volts, and they won't kill you. You wouldn't even feel that. But I promise you, 600 volts, that could kill you. So it's a little bit more dangerous, but there's a lot of energy density when we have voltages higher in these battery packs. And so what we're seeing now, to answer your question, is passenger vehicles like the Tesla cars and Audi and some of these other ones that Ford is producing and GM, they'll be in the 600 to 700 volt range, and they'll be using permanent magnet motors. And some of them are using AC induction motors too. They're really like a six phase induction motor, and they're very, very efficient, and they can produce a lot of power in a very small package. So hopefully that answers your question.
Oh, I think so. Is this going to be something that you're foreseeing somebody can plug in at their shop or at their business, or are there going to be charging stations for this? What type of charging capabilities do you foresee at the end of the day with this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jason. So one thing that Kinley and I have discussed is, if you have an electric vehicle, and let's just say that you, because Tesla's so popular and people seem to know a lot about them, whether it be a Tesla or another passenger light-duty vehicle, like a passenger car, if it's 600 volts DC, you've got several options to charge from. There's a couple different ISO connectors that you can use that are certified, and they're utilized throughout the world, actually. The International Standards Organization is certified these as connectors, similar to a wall connector that we'd use in our house. So you could charge electric vehicles off of 110, which would be a wall outlet in your house. And if it was a larger battery pack, like a 100 kilowatt hour pack, you'd have a really long charge time, because it's only 120 volts. It's AC voltage that needs to be converted to DC. And you could have like a 12 or 14 hour charge time, depending on the size of your battery pack. But if your house out, say that you pulled into your garage, and in your garage you had an outlet similar to what you'd have for your dryer, or a larger appliance like an oven that was 240 volts, well, then it would reduce the charge time in half almost. And then if you stepped it up even farther, Jason, you could charge, if you wanted to, you could put in a Tesla charging bank inside of your house that would, if you had power available and had 480 volts of single phase, or even some of these places will have three phase power, now your charging time is clear to nothing. You could have a 2 hour charge time to go, you know, another 400 miles or 300 miles. So it all depends on what voltage is available at a charging place, but it could actually be charged off of 120 or 240 or 480. And then we've got some of these mega chargers to where, you know, they're actually utilizing really high voltage and high amperage to charge your car in like 30 minutes, you know, or less. Or if it was like an F-150 Lightning or something like that, or a Rivian electric truck. So a lot of the larger Tesla charging stations, depending on where they're located, they could have really large amounts of power that are available, so you can charge quicker. And the batteries are able to take a charge that fast. Some batteries aren't, but lithium iron phosphate batteries can take a really fast charge, high voltage, because they're set up in a bank of batteries, probably close to 600 volts or more.
I was going to ask you, is this going to be a lithium based, or is there some sort of super cobalt, or what kind of rare earth minerals are we talking about behind this type of battery?
That's a great question. There's so many different battery technologies available right now, but for this project, probably the most proven and most readily available at this time is lithium iron phosphate, or LiPo. Like they've kind of coined like the LiPo4 battery or lithium iron phosphate battery. There's a lot of different ways I think you could kind of skin that cat too. There's cylindrical cells that would be very similar to what Panasonic has produced for Tesla. And what Panasonic's a really large producer of lithium iron phosphate batteries for a plethora of devices, whether it's cell phones or laptops or solar panel battery banks or light duty or heavy duty vehicles. So they use a cylindrical cell. There's some hexagonal cells that we've seen come out of China that are not really that bad, but it's not a domestic product. It'd be foreign. And there's a lot of really neat battery technologies that are emerging right now that they stand to be proven, you know, as far as over time, but they seem to be really, really viable. And that's probably our largest hurdle that we're up against, is the more weight you pull, Jason, and Kinley's aware of this, the more weight you're pulling, the higher amount of amperage your vehicle will utilize, and the more energy it will consume. So then what you need to do is you'll have to add batteries. Well, when you add batteries, you add an extensive amount of weight. So then it's just this, you know, you've got this teeter-totter effect where you're just going to continue to add batteries, but you'll add weight and it will consume more power to pull that much weight. And so We've came a long ways in the last 10 years, and I hopefully we're going to go farther, but that's kind of where we're at right now. I mean, you get to this point where 600 kilowatt hours of batteries on a semi-truck, you could have 8 or 10,000 pounds worth of batteries, depending on what type of heating and cooling system they have. You could have a lot of batteries on it to try to go 300 miles. And that's really the biggest hurdle right there.
My understanding is that when these motors and batteries come to fruition, there is a lot less maintenance on them. Is that the case with this that you're seeing too?
I think so. If the charge times and cycles, it'd be similar to, you know, when cell phones, and I don't want to date us or date myself, but, you know, I can think about in the late 90s when Nokia kind of had the brick phones, and those had a different base of battery. They were not lithium. You know, most of those are nickel cadmium batteries. But they would kind of have what we could quote unquote a memory. And people would say, well, they have a battery memory, and if you'll fully discharge them and then fully cycle them, you'll get the most amount of use out of those. And usually it was less than 2 years. Well, because of lithium iron phosphate, a lot of specialists have said they don't have a memory like that, but it's not really true. They're damaged by high heat and low temperatures. So anything under 20 degrees is really harmful on them to discharge them or charge them. And then anything over about 80 degrees actually is harmful to them. So, and some people said they can withstand 100 to 120 degrees. They can, but you'll see less charge cycles out of them. But we also know that the battery pack, if you have a battery pack that they can range in price anywhere, 100 kilowatt hours at one point in time, we thought, okay, that would be like a $20,000 battery pack. And we've seen it as low as $12,000, but we've seen them as high as $50,000. I mean, they're just, I read an article one time, the guy talked about how he's like, I don't want to replace the battery pack in my Tesla. It costs more than the car cost to replace a 100 kilowatt hour pack or an 80 kilowatt hour pack. And that's something to think about. But I think that to answer your question, the battery pack should last somewhere between 5 to 7 years. And I don't know exactly how many charge cycles, but they should have over 10,000 charge cycles in a lithium iron phosphate pack. If there has not been abuse where temperatures were too high or temperatures were too low during a discharge cycle.
And Jason, just to bring this idea full circle, that's one of the very unique things about this project is that Levi is really thinking about from the perspective of how do we control the temperature of these batteries. And one of the great advantages of moving to this hybrid, marrying the advantages of a gas-based motor and the advantages of electric, is that you've got built into it a cooling and heating system for these batteries to help keep them at the proper temperature, so you do get the most out of that life cycle. And I don't think anybody else currently in the market or merging into the market is really thinking of it from that perspective. One of the things that really makes Levi and his leadership on this project very unique.
Interesting about the temperature and some of those different things. Are there any other idiosyncrasies or variables that are, you know, pretty critical in this project?
I don't think so. I think that just so choosing the motor. So Jason, if you can think about this just a little bit, and our listeners, if the truck, so our current diesel engines usually produce, if it was a 14 liter engine, like the larger class 8 engines that are 12 to 14 liters in displacement, their reciprocating piston engine, usually they're 1,650 to 2,050 foot-pounds of torque. So they, and with that, that's at the crank, that's at the flywheel, so at the crankshaft. Now we have to couple that power and send it down the driveline, and every time, 100% of the time, it will be pushed through a transmission. And the transmission will have, if it's, let's just say it's a straight 10 speed, because that's popular, it could be a 13 or an 18 speed, but 10 speed transmissions, they usually have an 8-to-1 reduction low gear, and then from first gear or low all the way up to 10th, those are all reduction gears. And as soon as you get to 10th gear, it could be direct in 10th, but it could also be an overdriven 10th gear where it'd have a percentage of it that was overdriven. But let's just say 10th is direct. So if it's 2,000 foot-pounds of torque, but your very lowest gear is an 8-to-1 reduction, well, all of a sudden coming out the back of the transmission, we have 16,000 foot-pounds of torque because we reduced it by 8 times, but we compounded the torque that many times. So now there's 16,000 foot-pounds coming through the drive line, and then our differential is a 4-to-1 reduction. Well, now we compound it 4 more times. So you can see that the torque is really amplified at the axle shafts in a conventional semi-truck or tractor setup on the road, a Class 8 truck, where the electric, they make a lot of torque at low RPM, but the thing that I foresee, they're just not utilizing transmissions. It reduces the efficiency. You use way more amps. So Kenley and I designed this project where we want to have at least a 2-speed, so it's got some reduction, and then as soon as you're moving down the road, probably in the 38 to 40, 42 mile an hour range, you could shift into direct, and you could pull a really heavy load in low, and then you could move 75 or 80, whatever the speed limit is for the Class 8 trucks. You could go that fast in direct and not consume a lot of amperage. And Tesla has a similar version. They actually have 4 motors, one at each corner, that they're utilizing that are very small motors. They're actually motors out of the Tesla Plaid car. And then they'll use a 2-speed gearbox at each corner, or each drive axle corner, they'll have a 2-speed box. So it seems complicated. It's not traditional. They'll have to have a network of mechanics that know how to work on it. And we're more so trying to utilize technology that we've had for a while, and then just put a motor in front of the differentials, and lots of different options there. I like the idea of just having a motor and drivelines and 2-speed gearbox outside of conventional axles, so they can still be worked on the truck shop, and most mechanics or technicians that understand how to work on it.
Just taking a look at the clock here, and I see we got about 5 minutes left, and I know we wanted to talk a little bit about transmission, and that might be for a different day. I'm kind of curious about just how this is going to integrate into the grid, because when we're talking about, we've got 120,000 charging stations now globally. But when I think of I was just looking online as of 2012 or 2020, and there's like 80,000 that are a little bit more or higher and or something like that. And so, when I think of semis, they talked about building semis their own highway back when George Sr., I think, was president. They wanted to have like a super highway down I-29 from Winnipeg down to Houston. And so, semis and, any sort of transportation, logistical supply chain, having their own charging station specifically isn't out of line. I'm more curious about the integration part. Do you see this happening seamlessly, or do you think there'll be a little bit of a hiccup in the first couple years?
Yeah, I think it just depends on how many consumers or fleets buy into the all electric semi trucks. If it's class eight and it's OTR, over the road or long haul, I don't think it'll happen for a while. And it'd be great if it could. I just don't foresee it. I think one thing we talked about in the past was just the number of trucks that are on the freeways right now that are over the road or running coast to coast or locally. There's enough of them that, in the Magic Valley where I live, there's so many different truck stops that are along this highway or the corridor there. Each one of them, I just think of one like a Pilot or a Love's or a Flying J or one of these popular truck stops. At any given time, you can go there. If I went there tonight, there would be close to 100 semi-trucks and trailers parked because there's drivers that have hit their DOT period of time that they can drive, and now they have bunk time. So if they're in their bunk 8 hours and they're pulled over at a truck stop, which is what they're designed for, that would be the ideal time for them to charge. And I just don't think our infrastructure at all right now could handle 100 trucks at every truck stop, or even say it was only 50 trucks charging and pulling in one night. They're trying to charge a bank of batteries that would have between 600 to 1000 kilowatt hours. And just put in perspective, and again, I know we talked about this before, but a household of four usually utilizes somewhere between 450 to 600 kilowatt hours in a 1 month or a 30-day period. So in one night, we're trying to charge one truck enough power into what, similar to what a family of four would use in a month. And if we had 50 of them at every one of these truck stops around the country, wow, can you imagine that our grid has to change? I think that's why Kinley and I pushed so hard to have this be a hybrid with not only a range extension device, but a device on it, a low emission piston engine that could actually charge the battery without having to plug into the grid. But if you had grid available and it was there, then you could utilize it. So you could do one or the other.
Well, as we kind of wrap up here, Kenley, any final thoughts this week as we talk about EV engines? I know you've actually been an EV car owner in the past, so any thoughts on something along this lines?
In response to your question, I think that I've been a hybrid owner multiple times, and I can tell you that it really appeals to me because it truly does marry the best of both worlds and gives you as a driver flexibility. You're not completely relying upon the grid. You're not completely worried about how far you can go because you have that gas in there that if needed, it can kick it on and can really extend your range. And so all that range anxiety that so many people are going through that have switched over to the complete electric vehicles, those people that only drive 16 miles a day, they're fine. You know, they'll be just fine. But anybody that's driving, 100, 300, 400, miles a day, you're going to experience range anxiety. And so this hybrid project, as Levi said, we've pushed hard for this idea because we want to eliminate a lot of those issues and find a way to show that if you marry the technologies, you get something even better.
All right, Levi, anything in closing?
I think that's great. Appreciate the time today, Jason. It's exciting. There's new frontier, I think, with all of this, and hopefully it's going in the right direction. I like the direction it's going now, and we'll see what happens. We're getting closer on the project, so I'm glad we get to keep in touch with you on it.